Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Comment ma fille et moi pouvons-nous définir qui peut lui envoyer des messages? Comment parler avec mon fils des bons comportements à adopter en ligne? Si vous avez des questions sur la sécurité de vos ados en ligne, vous trouverez des ressources utiles dans le Centre Familial Instagram. Le Centre Familial vous permet de paramétrer la supervision parentale avec votre ado. Et dans l'espace éducation, vous trouverez des conseils d'experts pour discuter de sécurité. Découvrez nos outils pour la famille sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
The Global Story, with smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story. Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 30th of November, these are our main stories. 16 hostages who had been held by Hamas in Gaza have been freed on the sixth day of a pause in hostilities. US prosecutors say an Indian government employee directed a failed plot to assassinate a Sikh activist in New York. Also in this podcast... That is the music of spheres, in this case a perfect solar system 100 light years away. But we start with the war in Israel and Gaza. 16 more hostages have been released by Hamas as part of a ceasefire arrangement in return for Palestinian prisoners. The hostages were handed over by Hamas late on Wednesday evening to the International Committee of the Red Cross. Negotiations on extending a truce beyond Wednesday have been continuing. Meanwhile, Israel's military says it's checking a claim by Hamas that the youngest hostage, a 10-month-old baby, Kafir Bibas, his 4-year-old brother and the pair's mother were killed in an Israeli aerial bombing. You may remember pictures of the children with their distinctive red hair. Israel's cabinet minister Benny Gantz said he had had an emotional meeting with the Bibas family members.
First of all, I did meet with members of the Bibas family. It was a painful meeting and became even more painful after the developments reported by the media emerged. Those reports are not confirmed, but they're painful, and I don't know if they're true or not true. But it's certainly part of the brutal psychological warfare that our enemies are undertaking.
Well, just before recording this podcast, I spoke to our correspondent Paul Adams. He's based in Jerusalem, and we covered much of the developments today in Israel and Gaza, but I started by asking him for more information on the latest hostage release.
16 hostages were handed over to the Red Cross tonight. That included 12 Israelis, several of them dual nationals, and 4 Thais. And yes, that does bring to an end the kind of agreed 6 consecutive exchanges, because we will see sometime later on this evening another group of 30 Palestinian prisoners also released. What we don't know is where it goes from here, because at the moment, even though we have heard in recent days expressions of a willingness on both sides to have more of this, because it seems to be working, at the moment we don't actually have any agreement. And there is some suggestion that Hamas is not happy with some of the terms being offered. So there is an element of doubt about whether we will see another round of exchanges tomorrow or whether we will be back to Israel's military operation.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, that could be the outcome, could it? Within hours, there is no extension and military operations resume.
That is certainly a possibility, and it is one that rhetorically, at least, Israeli officials from the Prime Minister on down seem to be preparing the ground for or warning about. But, as I say, because this exchange of hostages and prisoners has gone ahead essentially without a hitch for 6 days now, and that both sides seem to believe that it's a process that is yielding the things that they want, the hostages, obviously, with more women and children still remaining in captivity, and, of course, a significant number now of Palestinian prisoners, it is perfectly possible that they will both decide to keep this going for a few more days. We just haven't had that word yet.
OK, just quickly, Hamas tonight apparently making proposals to suggesting the release of all the Israeli soldiers they hold in exchange for all Palestinians in prisons in Israel. I mean, is that bluntly a goer?
Not at the moment at all. In fact, one senior Israeli official earlier today was saying that they hadn't even heard of such a deal. I mean, that would be, I mean, that is the deal to end all deals. That would be astonishing, frankly, if a deal was reached that would result in the release of all of the remaining hostages, who include a great number of Israeli soldiers, both male and female, and presumably a very, very large number of Palestinian prisoners. That's something that I think, you know, is being pushed for, looked for by international diplomats, but I don't think at the moment is on the cards.
Just finally, Paul, and far more troubling tonight, the Israeli military is looking into these claims from Hamas that the Bibas family, the mother, the two sons who become these symbols of the war for many in Israel are dead. Hamas claiming they died in an Israeli aerial attack. What do we know of that?
We don't have any confirmation of that. Yes, Hamas made that claim. Yes, the Israelis are looking into it. Members of the Bibas family have said they hope the information proves false and they've asked for privacy. But certainly any sense of relief or joy among Israelis tonight at the release of another group of hostages is hugely tempered by a profound sense of apprehension about the fate of Shiri Bibas and her two boys, Ariel and Kafir, who, as you say, have really become symbols of this whole dreadful story.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Well, more than 8 weeks into the Israel-Gaza war, aid agencies now fear that a lack of basic hygiene in Gaza will see diseases spread rapidly there. Wira Davis has more.
Even if the current pause in hostilities is extended by a few days, Israel has made it clear the military offensive will soon resume, targeting what remains of Hamas's capabilities in southern Gaza. That, say aid agencies, will exacerbate what is already a dire humanitarian situation, particularly around the southern city of Khan Yunis, where people sought refuge from the fighting in the north. The fragile truce of the past 6 days has allowed the UN and others to assess what damage 7 weeks of bombing has done and what pressing needs the population now has. Thomas White is the Director of Affairs in Gaza for the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency.
We cannot get enough aid in through the Rafah crossing. And right now, as winter approaches, with poor sanitation, we're very concerned about an outbreak of infectious diseases such as watery diarrhea, as people are forced to live in very cramped conditions with poor sanitation.
Nariman is living in a tent in southern Gaza. Her baby daughter is 23 days old, younger than the war itself, and her whole family is sick. She says she doesn't have enough money to buy her daughter medicine. She needed medical support to help her breathe. Her husband has heart disease and high blood pressure. Israel has denied there's a humanitarian crisis and points to the 200 or so trucks being allowed daily into Gaza, bringing in much-needed food, medicines and limited fuel supplies. It's thought that more than 1 million Gazans are now living in temporary shelters, having been forced from their homes elsewhere in the besieged Palestinian territory. If and when the bombing resumes, thousands of internally displaced people in Gaza will face the prospect of having to move on again to areas with much less aid and even fewer resources.
Wira Davis reporting from Jerusalem. We're going to go to the US now and a story that also involves India and Canada. With allegations of a state-sponsored assassination abroad and conspiracy to kill others, alarm has grown about what India's government and its intelligence agencies may be doing in foreign countries. In New York City on Wednesday, prosecutors charged an Indian national with being part of a foiled plot to murder a Sikh activist on US soil. The Biden administration has already warned India over evidence of its involvement in plots to kill Indians abroad. All of this is just a few months after relations between India and Canada plummeted after the Canadian government said there were credible allegations that Indian agents were involved in the murder of another Sikh activist, this time in Vancouver. For more, I spoke to our North America correspondent, Neda Torfik.
Prosecutors allege that this Indian man, Nikhil Gupta, was recruited in May by an Indian government employee in this murder-for-hire plot to kill the Sikh activist in New York. And they say that Nikhil Gupta had been involved in international narcotics and weapons trafficking, and he was attempting to hire a hitman for $100,000 to kill this activist, allegedly. And they say that this individual he was trying to hire was, in fact, a confidential source working with U.S. authorities, working with the U.S. Drug and Enforcement Agency. And they say that the Indian government employee gave Nikhil Gupta information about the target, his day-to-day activities, his address, his phone number. And when that Sikh Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijaran, was killed in British Columbia, they say Nikhil Gupta sent a video of that to this hitman he thought he was hiring and said it was now time to go ahead. There was no need to wait. It was time to carry out that assassination, that target. And the United States says that they foiled that plot and went on to discuss how this is an ongoing investigation, how that this has been raised with the highest levels in the Indian government.
So just to be clear on this, there are allegations made in that New York court today about an attempt to kill someone on U.S. soil, a Sikh activist. But what happened in Canada did happen, didn't it? That was a murder of a man there that did go ahead, a distinctly different and more serious case.
That's right. But this indictment alleges that the two were associates and that the man, Nikhil Gupta, told this hitman he thought he was hiring, who was instead a U.S. official, that Hardeep Singh Nijaran was one of their targets as well, along with others. So what we had heard from the Canadian foreign minister today, Melanie Joy, she didn't comment on the U.S. case, but she said that they stand by their credible allegations that the Indian government was involved there. And the United States says that they have dispatched their director of national intelligence to India to share the additional information they have so India can carry out their own investigation.
Neda Torfik in New York. Well, let's stay in the US because a congressman who lied about his life and career on the way to being elected just last year will find out today, Thursday, if he's being expelled. George Santos became one of the first openly gay Republicans in Congress last November. But since then, a litany of accusations and deceptions has followed. Now, the Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, who's on the same political side as Mr. Santos, has said the vote on whether to expel him is coming.
So what we've said as a leadership team is we're going to allow people to vote their conscience. I think it's the only appropriate thing we can do. We've not whipped the vote, and we wouldn't. I trust that people will make that decision thoughtfully and in good faith. I personally have real reservations about doing this. I'm concerned about a precedent that may be set for that. Everybody's working through that, and we'll see how they vote.
So with the prospect of expulsion coming, I spoke to our correspondent Anthony Zerker in Washington, who told me more about George Santos.
The nub is that he abused his position as a candidate, essentially using campaign money for his own personal benefit. He raised campaign figures. He fraudulently misrepresented the kind of money he had. And then the money he did have, he spent on personal expenditures such as clothing and internet services, adult internet services. That was detailed in a report by the Congressional Ethics Committee. And that multi-page, 100-page report, once the members of Congress viewed it, I think it became very clear that George Santos had lost support within even among Republicans in the House of Representatives, which is why this, the third attempt to oust him since George Santos was elected, seems like it is the most likely to be successful.
And it would be highly unusual, am I right? I mean, barely a handful of members of Congress have been expelled in the past.
Only two in the modern era. There are more dating back to the post-Civil War, during the Civil War era of the 1860s. But it is extremely rare, and never before has someone not connected to the Confederacy or not been convicted of a crime in a court been expelled. So this would be unusual in that regard. But George Santos is a relatively new arrival to Capitol Hill. He has few allies within the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. So that may have made it easier, although it hasn't been all that easy, but easier to expel him because he doesn't have those kind of deep roots in Washington.
Anthony Zerker. Now, the 2023 UN Climate Change Conference, also known as COP28, begins in Dubai today. The president of COP28, Sultan Al-Jaber, has denied that his country planned to use the meeting to strike oil and gas deals. Leaked documents obtained by the BBC and the Centre for Climate Reporting earlier this week revealed proposals to discuss fossil fuel projects with 15 nations at the talks going on in Dubai. In their response to that claim, the UAE team did not deny using COP28 meetings to discuss business. They said that private meetings were private. So, as COP28 gets underway, many countries around the world are facing problems relating to changes in climate, such as hotter temperatures or the prospect of flooding. With sea levels rising around the globe, Miami, in the US state of Florida, is facing an urgent need to adapt as property investors turn their gaze inland, away from the exclusive low-lying beach area. Residents in one poorer neighbourhood, further above sea level, say rising rents are forcing them out. Natalia Tsuo has been speaking to locals campaigning against what they call climate gentrification.
On a warm summer day, a crowd gathers outside Eglise du Nazarene Church in Miami. People jerk in line as volunteers hand out food parcels. Prices in this neighbourhood have been increasing. It's called Little Haiti. Much of Little Haiti is made up of low-income housing. Miami has become hotter and more humid in recent years, making some poorly maintained properties uninhabitable. At the same time, rents have spiked, pushing many residents of Little Haiti into housing insecurity.
Money, 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 money! Money! Money, money, money! It's money.
Renita Holmes is one of them.
Miami born and raised. I'm an African-American inner-city woman that loves my city and loves my community.
She moved into a new flat earlier this year. Many of her belongings are still in boxes.
So I haven't unpacked this time. This is my fourth move in 3 years. So curtains are a luxury, and that's what aluminum foil does in making sure that covering my windows keeps the humidity down.
Renita's dog Zion is suffering because of the humidity.
I'm sorry, Zion.
She dabs his paws with a wet cloth. But humidity isn't the only issue. In Miami, sea levels have risen by 15 centimetres in the past 31 years. The city has become more prone to flooding. Little Haiti is located on a limestone ridge, about 5.5 metres above sea level, and is perceived as more resilient to flooding, with new wealthy buyers seeking a safe investment and pricing out the existing community.
There were people who have seen flyers, who have seen ads, and who have talked to real estate salespeople and heard, but hey, you'll know you'll be in higher ground, you'll be safer from the floods, you'll be safer from the storms, you'll be safer from sea level rise.
Professor William Butler of Florida State University has researched climate gentrification in Little Haiti. He says it's too soon to say whether it is the key driver of rent inflation, but he thinks it's clearly a factor.
That adds one more layer to drivers of displacement of lower-income people who are the most stressed in the context of climate change in the first place.
Would you like to go on a toxic tour? Let's go.
Renita Holmes wants to help her community push back against these pressures, visiting neighbours to raise awareness on the day-to-day impact of climate change.
I go down the street and I talk to my sisters. I teach them what I know. Yeah, as long as I got empowerment, resilience and a voice, yeah, I live here.
Reporting from Miami, that was Natalia Tsuo. Still to come on the Global News podcast, the legacy of this woman. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. There's an update in the saga of Aretha Franklin's will that was found stuffed down the back of a sofa.
Comment ma fille et moi pouvons-nous définir qui peut lui envoyer des messages? Comment parler avec mon fils des bons comportements à adopter en ligne? Si vous avez des questions sur la sécurité de vos ados en ligne, vous trouverez des ressources utiles dans le Centre Familial Instagram. Le Centre Familial vous permet de paramétrer la supervision parentale avec votre ado. Et dans l'espace éducation, vous trouverez des conseils d'experts pour discuter de sécurité. Découvrez nos outils pour la famille sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
Hi there, Global News podcast listeners. I'm Katia Adler, and I want to tell you about my new BBC podcast, The Global Story, where you can join us for an in-depth look at one big story every weekday. The Global Story helps make sense of the headlines with expert analysis from BBC journalists around the world. One global story at a time, in detail, daily. So, keep up to date with all the latest global events right here on the Global News podcast, and then join me for a closer look at a story making the headlines on The Global Story from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to this podcast, the Global News podcast. Now, politics is moving fast in Pakistan. On Wednesday morning, it was revealed that the country's former Prime Minister, Imran Khan, was to step down as chairman of his own PTI party. He's currently in jail and is barred from standing in the election that's due in February. A few hours later, a court in Islamabad quashed a corruption allegation against his main rival, Nawaz Sharif. It was only a few weeks ago that Mr. Sharif arrived back in Pakistan after years in exile abroad, where he was avoiding jail on that corruption conviction. The three times Prime Minister has one last legal hurdle to cross before he can stand in the election in just a few months' time. So what are his chances of making it a fourth time as the country's Prime Minister? Well, I asked BBC Urdu's Asif Farooqi.
So Nawaz Sharif was acquitted in one of the two cases that he was convicted of a couple of years ago. This is significant in terms of his political narrative building. He's going into elections, which are scheduled for 8th February. He can go to public now and say that, look, you know, here I am cleared by the courts and I am not a corrupt man anymore. But there is another case which is pending, decision is pending in that case also. And the way the court is hearing that case, it is very likely that a verdict on that case would also be, you know, announced before the elections.
But it looks like we're seeing the kind of rehabilitation of Nawaz Sharif, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a very interesting word, rehabilitation. That's what everyone is saying in the country. Pakistan People's Party, one of the opponents' party, they call him the blue-eyed of the military establishment. And that's what the baggage is for him now. In the last election, the baggage was the corruption, that, you know, he was the most corrupt man in the country. But now, while the courts are, you know, acquitting him, he is faced with this another narrative that is going against him, that he is being supported by the military establishment.
All right, well, let's talk about that. And I know that we could talk about this for days and days, but the significance of Pakistan's military within its national politics and their relationship with Nawaz Sharif, where are we on those things?
It's not really a relationship with Nawaz Sharif, to be honest. It's military in terms of who suits them to lead the country, who can work with them in a way that suits them. We saw in 2018 elections, it was Imran Khan who the military supported, and now it is Nawaz Sharif. So basically, it's a no-win situation for politicians, but it's a win-win situation for the military establishment. Who's calling the shots?
Just finally, let's assume for the sake of this discussion that Nawaz Sharif is cleared on the remaining charge, you know, and that rehabilitation is fulfilled. What are his political prospects now as we look to the elections early next year?
He is the front runner, to be honest. The problem is that if you go by the last elections, PTI, Imran Khan's party, is still the most popular party in the country. But that party is not being allowed to contest the elections properly. Their rallies are being disturbed. Their second-tier leadership is in jail. Imran Khan is really finding it hard to find the candidates to contest in like 300 seats in the country.
Asif Farooqi. Now, America's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has insisted there's no sense of fatigue in the NATO alliance when it comes to helping Ukraine. He added that there was continued support in Congress in the US, despite its resistance to an aid package for Ukraine. Kyiv is concerned the conflict in Gaza has drawn away the West's attention, as Sofia Batitsa reports from a NATO meeting in Brussels.
There is no Ukraine fatigue. This was the message of unwavering support that NATO foreign ministers were keen to project. there had been concerns that support from the United States, NATO's most powerful member, could falter as the country's preoccupied with the conflict in the Middle East. But Antony Blinken reassured NATO allies that America could handle two wars at the same time and that Russia could not be allowed to redraw borders by force. But there are 31 countries in NATO, and some of them are not keen on sending more aid to Kyiv. There is some frustration that despite substantial military support, which includes missiles from the UK and France, drones, ammunition and air defence, over the past year, Ukraine has not been able to achieve the territorial gains they were hoping for, and that the great counteroffensive they promised has not materialised.
We're going to stay in Europe because Finland is closing its entire 1,300-kilometre-long land border with Russia today after accusing Moscow of deliberately helping migrants cross into its territory. About 900 asylum seekers entered Finland from Russia this month. That's up from the normal monthly rate of under just 30. The authorities say the migrants come from countries such as Morocco, Pakistan and Syria. They accuse Russian authorities of engaging in what they call a hybrid attack. My colleague Tim Franks spoke to Mari Rantanen, Finland's interior minister.
We made this decision because these activities have continued despite the measures Finland has taken before. The risk that these activities will escalate poses a serious threat to national security and public order. And our message is that Finland don't accept this from Russian authorities.
You say a serious threat to national security. That's quite alarming language to use. I mean, we're talking about several hundred asylum seekers crossing into Finland. I mean, is that really a threat to national security?
This is not a case about the numbers. This is a case of hybrid operation where we know that Russian authorities are involved. So this makes it much more dangerous for national security. And the second thing is that the potential risk is very high. And we also know that these people who is coming now, the profile is that they are young males from African and Middle East countries. They have bought a visa to Russia and they continue their trip to Finnish border helped by Russian authorities. And this makes it a much more bigger risk. And that's why we have to act. And we want to say to Russian authorities that this needs to stop.
You will be aware, of course, that Russia denies that it's involved in this at all. You say that you know for certain that Russia is involved. I mean, are you able to make that evidence public? Are you able to explain just how, with what certainty, you know that Moscow is involved?
I was talking about the Russian authorities, which actually our reporters have even seen when they are on the border crossings. They can see that the Russian border guards are bringing people to our border. So we know exactly. Otherwise, they wouldn't bring them.
You've actually seen the Russian authorities involved in this operation.
Mm.
What do you say to, for example, the UN Refugee Agency's representative in the Nordic and Baltic countries, Annika Sandlund, who said that closing all border crossing points would be contrary, in her words, to international law, presumably on the grounds that you need to give people the opportunity to claim asylum.
Yes, well, these people have been coming thousands of kilometers to Russia. They have bought a visa to Russia. So, first of all, they can use another route. And the second thing is that if you are seeking asylum, I think you have on your own country some kind of threat to violence or stuff like that. So, well, they went to Russia. Why don't they apply asylum from there? They have legal right to stay in Russia. Yeah.
That was Mari Rantanen, Finland's interior minister. Now, I find some of the details in this next story just mind-blowing, if I'm honest, because astronomers have discovered what they've described as the perfect solar system. It consists of six planets, all about the same size, which have barely changed since the system was formed 12 billion years ago. Researchers say the undisturbed conditions make it ideal for scientists to learn how the planets formed and if they are home to life. With more, here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
Our own solar system had violent beginnings. Worlds crashed into each other as they formed, disturbing their orbits and eventually leading to the planets of vastly different sizes we know today. But 100 light years away, astronomers have found another solar system, one that was created in much calmer conditions without so many violent collisions. As a result, its six planets are of similar size, between 2 and 3 times bigger than the Earth, and their orbits are in perfect sync with each other. So much so that the researchers commissioned this piece of music, where each note corresponds to a completed orbit of each planet. Dr. Raphael Luque of the University of Chicago led the project.
It's a perfect solar system. It's in a perfect harmony. It's in a very beautiful orbital configuration, which is extremely rare. And unlike our solar system, its formation was very gentle, almost undisturbed for billions of years. And that is why these unique properties are going to allow us to learn how these planets form, evolve, and whether they can host life.
Astronomers have discovered thousands of solar systems in the past 30 years, but none of them is so well suited to study how planets formed as this one. The next step is to analyse the atmospheres of the newly discovered worlds to see if there are gases present that on Earth could only be produced by living organisms.
That was Pallab Ghosh. Now, we're going to end on the saga of the two wills, one found stuck down the back of a sofa, a collection of million-dollar houses and furs, and the musical legacy of this soul legend. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back. That was Aretha Franklin singing Think. Now, she died 5 years ago. Her place among America's soul legends is very much secure, but she left a bit of a legal mess for her immediate family. Two handwritten wills were found in her home, one with a smiley face. Earlier this year, a court ruled which one of those was valid. It turned out the smiley face one found in the sofa was valid. And on Wednesday, her sons finally took possession of her estate. I asked our music correspondent Mark Savage to take us back to the beginning.
When Aretha Franklin died 5 years ago in 2018, her family thought that she'd left no will at all. And under Michigan law, that would have meant that her assets would have been divided equally amongst all four of her sons. But then within a couple of months, they found two separate documents inside her house in Detroit. One was in a locked cabinet and the other was a spiral notebook that was stuffed between two cushions on her couch. And they were slightly different in how they divided up her estate between her four sons. Neither of those documents was prepared by a lawyer. Neither listed witnesses, but the first one was notarized. That came from 2010 and that said that her son should basically get equal rights to all of her property, of her music copyright, of the furs that she owned and the cash that she had in the bank. The second one, which was the one that was found down the back of a sofa, wasn't properly signed. She'd in fact put a smiley face inside the capital A of Aretha at the bottom of the letter. And it suggested that her youngest son, Kelf, should get her most expensive property, a $1.2 million gated mansion in the suburbs of Detroit. And there was then a long court argument over which of those documents carried more weight, because obviously, in some cases, it preferred one son over the other.
And I mean, has this been acrimonious? Has it been nasty?
It hasn't been nasty. They have taken it to court because they wanted basically a jury to decide which of those two wills was the most valid. In court, the two sons who had the most to gain or lose said that they still talked outside of the court, that things were stiff, but they got on as well as three old men could. That was the quote.
And this is about, you said fur coats, you talked about houses. I mean, what's at stake here?
Her estate was a portfolio of about $6 million worth of property. That's four houses. She had lots of cherished items like furs, jewellery, musical instruments, but also the copyright to the music that she recorded in her life. And of course, that includes iconic songs like Respect, like Think, I Say a Little Prayer, and all of the money that comes in from the royalties of those.
And presumably the most valuable part of the estate is the copyright, it is the music, that intellectual property. That's the most significant thing, is it?
I mean, certainly that is Aretha Franklin's legacy. And if you are in charge of the copyright of that music, then you get to say whether or not it gets used in a film, whether it gets used in a presidential campaign, say, and obviously whether there might be things like a film biopic of her life or a stage musical, then the person who is in charge of that copyright would get to make those calls. Now, under both of the two wills, essentially the music copyright was split evenly between the four sons. So really that side of it isn't in too much of contention. What they were really worried about at this stage was who got which property.
Well, that was Mark Savage on Aretha's two wills. That's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email, as always. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.